Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this, the sixth in the series on Europe, organised by the LSE and co-hosted by the European Institute here at the school. Before we begin tonight's lecture, let me just make a couple of announcements. Firstly, the lecture which is scheduled for the 5th of December with EU Commissioner Olli Rehn has been postponed and will be held at a date in the Lent term. And that leads me to emphasise the point that this series of public lectures will in fact continue next term, Lent term, here at the LSE. And there will be further announcements made of upcoming lectures. Let me insert here an additional announcement about a further lecture which will be held on Wednesday the 30th of November. The European Ombudsman, Professor Nikiforos Diamandouros, will give a lecture in the Shaw Library on the 30th of November at 11 a.m. The title of that lecture will be Human Rights and Non-Judicial Remedies, the European Ombudsman's Perspective. And it is a lecture hosted by the European Institute and the Centre for the Study of Human Rights here at the LSE. So we come to tonight's lecture. The title of tonight's lecture is suitably enigmatic. The question, where does Europe end, has many connotations. To Eurosceptics, of course, it might imply some kind of a promise of relief from a political project that seems to be without end. Their frustration may be more a matter of when will Europe end? When will the European Union end? Our speaker tonight may have some sympathy with such views, but his focus is with the definition and meaning of Europe. Certainly the answer to the question, what is Europe, has changed over time. And this inconsistency and variation is highly relevant to our current discussions about the enlargement of the European Union. The identity of Europe, I suggest, cannot be fixed easily by any single academic discipline or perspective. The meaning of Europe is at best ambiguous. Let me give you a few examples by way of introduction. The very name Europe derives, of course, from the myth about the king of Phoenicia. Phoenicia. In other words, it comes from what we now call Lebanon. We talk of Europe's inheritance from the Greeks and the Romans, but neither the Greeks nor the Romans made much reference to Europe, and of course the Greek and Roman empires straddled continents, were not exclusive to Europe. Later, the schism between the Catholic and Orthodox churches and the rise of the Ottoman Empire made the drawing of boundaries around Europe increasingly difficult. In a more contemporary setting, we can hardly get much greater clarity by asking what Europe stands for. Important European values have been exported and are no longer limited to the continent of Europe. Some refer to a European model in economics or welfare, but in reality, there seem to be many competing policy models evident across Europe. So a definition of Europe used to exclude new EU applicants, for example, would seem to be highly problematic to sustain. In any event, tonight's speaker is well placed to lead us through these complex issues. Norman Stone is now Professor of History at Koç University in Istanbul. He was previously Professor at Bilkent University in Ankara, Professor of Modern History at Oxford, and lecturer at Cambridge. Norman Stone is quite simply one of our most preeminent European historians. His books have covered a range of topics in 20th century European history. His book, The Eastern Front, 1914-1917, published in 1975, received widespread praise. Since then, he has written a major study of Adolf Hitler and a general history of Europe covering the period 1878 to 1919. I understand he's now returning to his earlier focus with a new book looking at the First World War from the Russian-Turkish angle. Norman Stone has frequently written in the international press and has often been cited as a major authority, consulted by the British governments, other governments, and questions of historical legacy. Normanstone has a reputation of not only being one of our best historians, but also as one of our most lively and controversial of historians. I think this evening we can expect to be provoked, challenged in our assumptions, our understandings about Europe, and we look forward to your questions afterwards. There will be plenty of time for questions after tonight's lecture. But without further ado, let me ask you to welcome our speaker this evening, Professor Normanstone, to discuss the question, where does Europe end?
Thank you, Chairman. It's very nice being back in this country. I'm very happy in Turkey. Never had a nanosecond of regret at going, but I suppose it's inevitable that I've been a little forgotten here. I've been telling people that I'm the man who put the pluperfect into has been. I've been given a rather difficult subject, the frontiers of Europe, and I think we'd have to admit, as a start, that the subject is terribly, terribly difficult to define. And, you know, since we're in England, I'm not even sure whether the job, strictly speaking, is worth it. These poor old people who tried to devise the Constitution for Europe, what an awful business that was. You know, you'd have thought that in a world where political science is not exactly unknown, the idea of having a conference of hundreds and hundreds of people to discuss subjects like the definition of Europe, obviously it was going to come up with a monstrosity. It duly did, and what a good thing that the masses of the people said rats to it. The best constitutions are short. The shorter the better. I had a look at the West German constitution of 1949, the Grundgesetz. It's mercifully short. It doesn't go wandering on. And the people who devised it were people who understood very well from the Weimar Constitution, that you simply don't go in for dotting every I and crossing every T. I always think that, you know, the best comment on the Weimar Constitution was what happened to the party that set it up, which was the Deutsche Demokratische Partei. Its successor in 1933 had 5 seats. Adolf Hitler said, "I want full powers." 2 of our members voted yes. 2 voted no, and the last one abstained, protesting that the others were splitting the party. Now, so I think I have to be very careful with these matters of definition. And now let's have a go at some of the obvious ones. Now, religion. Obviously, Europe is, in a certain sense, contiguous with Christianity. But in modern times, you couldn't get away with that, because, you know, to say, as Alain Besançon does, that Europe ends at the line of Gothic cathedrals, it's not a bad one. I mean, there are Gothic cathedrals as far southwest, southeast as Kronstadt, Brasov in Romania. There are in Zagreb, obviously. Half the way down Italy, and of course there are in Sicily. You can maybe argue that, but what do you do if the Gothic cathedrals are empty? So that doesn't really get you anywhere. And then again, Christianity is so divided. It's not just it's not just Christianity, it's the Latins and the Orthodox. It's Protestants and Catholics who continue to be, in so many ways, very, very different. You can tell almost at once when you're in a Protestant country and when you're in a Catholic one. I won't go on about that theme, but it's because it is too obvious. So you cannot say Christianity. Now, I get, I'm afraid, rather irritated in Turkey when people come from some European body or other to tell the Turks what they're getting wrong. Now, Turkey's a country which has got an awful lot right. In 1922, a quarter of its population, maybe even a third, had been wiped off the map or dumped outside. The Turks themselves, or at least the Muslims, if you want to say put it that way, were maybe a generation behind, perhaps two generations behind, the Christian quarter of the population. The best example I know is an actress called Shirin Devrim, who wrote in her memoirs that if you wanted a table made, the legs of which didn't wobble, you had to find an Armenian carpenter. Now, you take that country, 1922, produce it forward to now, and, you know, with all that's wrong with Turkey, there are things wrong with serious countries. It's a country which, you know, if you go and buy a television or a fridge outside, the likelihood is it's made in Turkey. So it's come a long way. Now, I get very irritated when European ministers come along and start lecturing the Turks about their shortcomings. You can see them arriving at Esenboğa Airport. You know, the finger has been twitching like this. When they fly over the Sea of Marmara, the finger comes out, and down they come those steps and saying, the Turks have to do this and the Turks have to do that, and the rights of women and the rights of minorities and torture in the prisons and child labour and the rest of it. Yes, but they might realise that the country has come an awful long way. It is. The only place, as far as I can judge, between Greece and Singapore, into which people actually want to immigrate, which says something. Now, that line is very much the sort of orthodox line that Europe is somehow about the rights of man. Now, if you look at the past of Europe, it's not really about the rights of man at all. 1789 was. That went in the direction we all famously know. Now, I used to advise Margaret Thatcher, and I wasn't altogether surprised at hearing how she had responded to the big, glossy revolution celebrations of the bicentenary of the revolution in 1989. She got along very well with Mitterrand. They'd read the same books. And she arrived at Calais and did an interview with Le Monde. I think it was Le Monde, and she said that all this stuff about the rights of man, why don't you just have a tradition like the English common law, which protects the rights of the individual without all this stuff and nonsense about the rights of man? Her reward was to be placed in the back level, the back rank of the official photograph, together with the representatives from places like Chad or the Central African Republic, perhaps the son of Emperor Bokassa. And she then proceeded to the opera, Le Garnier, where there was a performance of André Chénier, which was about 3.5-4 hours long. And at the end of it, she was whisked off, together with the others, to the new museum, as it then was, at the Quai d'Orsay, the director of which told me that, in the first place, she was the most impressive statesman she'd ever come across in the questions she asked about the pictures. But being a woman, she had the right to use what turned out to be the only lavatory. And protocol had forgotten to supply the gentlemen of the party with any sort of opportunity. She went down the stairs. She took her time. And this was her revenge. When she surfaced again, she had a whole gallery load of Union Française men leaping around in agonies. I'm afraid you're not really going to get anywhere if you talk in terms of rights of man, rights of individual. Europe has been quite an oppressive place, endless wars. I can't remember how many, but the wars go on and on and on. And it is right enough to say that the country which really does come up with some sort of tradition of rights of man is, well, this one. I teased my Turkish students, which was the first country to abolish slavery, and which was the last to abolish serfdom? They're both the same. It's England. Slavery really went in 1759, when the Mansfield judgment said, you can't have slaves on English soil. You could on Scottish soil. But nobody bothered to abolish serfdom because it was a hollow formality. It was just giving a cottage to some old geezer in return for mowing your lawn every Saturday afternoon, or something of that sort. And it was rather meanly abolished in 1935, when the aristocracy decided they would rather get some money in the agricultural slump for their cottages than give them for some sort of semi-charitable purpose. So serfdom was then abolished. Well, if you can't really talk about Europe in terms of Christianity, in terms of the rights of man, where do you go from there? And again, you come into another big problem. I'm sorry to be so negative. I will be positive after a bit. But the fact is that the European cultures themselves are really very different indeed. The obvious divisions are the ones between North and South. There's a very good German historian, Hans Ulrich Wehler, whom I've read with a lot of admiration over the years. He was one of these German historians who came up in the 1960s with a view to, as it were, modernizing the German historical tradition. And he wrote some very good articles. Now, he has turned pretty violently, I would say, anti-Turkish. And he wrote a famous article in Die Zeit where he said, the Turks will never immigrate, never assimilate. They have clientelistic politics. Now, let's leave aside the question of assimilation. Clientelistic politics, has that man ever been in southern Italy? Does he know how Spain works? Does he know how Greece works? Clientelistic politics in the Mediterranean have been something of a phenomenon since that again well-known phenomenon, the decline of the Mediterranean. Now, the decline of the Mediterranean is an interesting subject. How is it that a small primitive country like, well, shall we say for the sake of argument, Scotland, gets catapulted into the world's eye when places like Sicily, which had been part of Rome, which had been one of the causes of the Peloponnesian War, simply decline into a sort of festering slum? How does this happen? Is it climate change? Is it the nature of the Counter-Reformation to chase out the decent people? What is it that causes this? Now, whatever caused it, you find that politics gets controlled by the local big man. In Spain, it's called caciquismo. It's part of the same phenomenon. It happens in poor countries with dry agriculture, and politics becomes form of economic activity. And of course it's dangerous, because you can't really operate any kind of, well, for want of a better word, universal suffrage democracy. In fact, liberalism is quite difficult unless you are dealing with liberal landowners, which in southern Italy did happen. In fact, at the very heart of the creation of Italy was an example of this. They held a referendum in, I think, 1860. Are you in favour of the unification of Italy under Savoy or not? The results of that referendum were for unification of Italy, 800,000. Against unification of Italy, 300,000. Abstain, 8 million. It's the world of that wonderful book, The Leopard, which I keep telling the Turks to read. Anytime they feel paranoid about the Europeans' attitude to them, I always say, and look at other Mediterranean countries, of which I'm going to say something more. Now, as I say, why the European South went in this direction and the European North went on to create the Atlantic world, which we know, and which obviously the London School of Economics is a prime fruit of, is a mystery. People who know the subject far better than I do have written about it, so I won't go on too much about the subject. But the fact is, Wehler is wrong. Clientelistic politics is a Mediterranean phenomenon. How do you deal with it? Your mezzogiorno. Very difficult. Now, back to my question of definition. You're really left with a question of a geographical area, and whether Europe ends on the Vistula, on the Bug, or the River Meuse in the Caucasus, I don't know. As far as I can see, we are really talking about an idea. And I'm sorry to have been so relentlessly negative about it so far, but let's now try and say something a bit positive. Well, now, if we're talking about the Europe that we now live with, I started off as, it used to be called a Eurosceptic. Frankly, because I was bored with it when I was living in this country and couldn't really see why. Do we have to go through all these arguments again? Going to Turkey, I saw Europe from a rather different perspective. I'm not really sure if this country should be part of it at all. We are. Let it be. Certainly, from the point of view of the Turks, it becomes a much more interesting question, does Europe? Now, of course, let us admit for the start that it's been a considerable success, but what got it going? It's not the original European consciousness at all. Europe started off quite straightforwardly because of the Marshall Plan. A few idealists, a Count Coudenhover here, one or two others elsewhere, would talk about how Europe must get together. Sensible people said that sort of thing. But Europe didn't really begin to get together until it got a great prod from the Americans. It's really that winter of 1946-47, which as a very small boy I can remember. It was quite ferocious. George Marshall saw what was happening to Western Europe. He travelled by train to one of those futile conferences in Moscow, and he could see France on the verge of civil war. There were bombs on the railway lines. Germany, millions of people living in little cairns of rubble, which they'd constructed from bombed buildings, selling themselves for cigarettes. And he thought, this cannot go on. We must do something. And he waves his wand. $13,000,000,000, a considerable sum of money for the time. Very considerable. Was it something like 5% of the American GDP? Something of that sort. Now, the Americans had learned from the protectionism of the 30s. And we had learned too, and so had some of the French. And they said, we're not going to waste our money if you are going to refuse to trade with each other. So you set up, in the first instance, some sort of organization for cooperation and development in Europe, which still exists in the way international organizations exist, though it collects statistics nowadays. It sets up its own bank, the Bank of International Settlements, which had been set up originally to deal with German reparations. And believe it or not, it was the second American man who said, why don't you have a common currency? It's an American idea, not a European one. The Europeans all said, no, it's far too early. And you know, people blame the British for standing aside at that time, but for all, you know, the British had an empire to get rid of. It was a terribly, terribly difficult thing to do. Managing the money was terribly difficult. Maybe it was a mistake not to be involved in Europe in the early 1950s, but if so, it's a very, very forgivable mistake. Well, Europe gets set up more or less at American dictation, and it is really to be defined, I think, in terms of another institution of that period, NATO. We are talking really about NATO Europe, and let's not make any bones about it. You're not really going to find any better definition. Now, give or take some minuses, and there are minuses. Europe has been really rather a remarkable success. Now, let me quote what I think is the best example of what I'm talking about. You take a country which has got 1,000 years of Islam, and I mean Islam at its grandest. You give it a world empire. Its ships, its infantry are everywhere. Then, round about 1700, it begins to collapse. You find, for instance, that in its major university, there is one question left in one faculty because all the dons are busy doing something else, and they don't want to mark exams, so they have one question, and it's to be answered in Latin, and that question is, what language do the angels speak? Now, you throw in some other problems. You'll have guessed by now I'm talking about Spain. You throw in some other problems. Now, if you go from Ankara to Istanbul, it takes you 10.5 hours, if there are no delays, to go by train. Now, why? And the answer is that the Turkish railway program of the... Well, it dates back to the days of the Berlin-Baghdad railway, does that particular line. You have to do it a bit cheaply. There's not that much money around. There isn't much economic activity to sustain the thing. Now then you build in difficult country. The climate extremes are very considerable. The rock splinters. In the winter, with the ice, the rails expand, and in the summer they contract. So trains have to go very, very slowly indeed. There are other problems. Once your trains begin to break down, you cannot replace them with modern trains because you haven't the money. You have to repair them. And in time, that actually means setting up factories to create obsolete spare parts for your railway line. So it becomes a millstone hanging round your neck. Spain, it took 10 hours to get from Madrid to Barcelona for exactly the same reasons. An eroded landscape, a poor country, peasants taking chickens to market. I could talk about many other points in common with Spain. Let's take the question of minorities. Now, it annoys me very considerably when I hear Europeans lecturing the Turks about how to treat minorities. The Europeans' record in this, and we'll leave gas chambers out of it, isn't terribly good. The Swedes, for instance, were sterilizing the Lapps quite merrily right into the 1970s on the grounds that they were rather little and drank too much. If you tried to speak Breton in a French school, you were beaten with a clog for speaking it in the playground. I mean, I can multiply these examples more or less endlessly. Gladstone's Wales, for instance, if you spoke Welsh in the playground, you got beaten. No nonsense there about tolerating minorities. Now look, let me be utterly frank with you about this. I'm a Scotsman, as you no doubt hear. If in the year of grace, 1707, when Scotland was taking over England, if somebody had come up with Copenhagen criteria and pronounced, or whatever it might have been, that the Gaelic language was to be made legitimate as part of Scottish education, I know what would have happened to me, poor old me. I would have been the national poet. I would have been drunk most of the time. My audience would have amounted to 10 people, highly critical. And I'd have been living off handouts from the European Union. At a certain point, it is simply not a kindness to encourage minorities to get up to sort of folklore languages. I think I can now say it even amounts to a communist plot, if you see what I mean, in that these minorities were usable by communists in very unscrupulous ways. Now, Spain with Catalonia had something which was a generation ahead of the rest of Spain, and still, I suppose, is. Barcelona's a rather wonderful place. Spain also had Kurds in the shape of the Basques. Now, the Kurdish question is a very sensitive one, I'm well aware, and I think pretty well every Turk would agree that the Turkish state has not handled it very well. Kurds have been left feeling rather second-class citizens. And when you create that kind of, I say, nimbus of animosity, then you're no longer really dealing with something practical which can be dealt with in committees with concessions about a language or anything of that sort. A certain kind of animosity builds up. Now, one big problem is that the Kurds, like, I gather, the Basques, are very, very divided. There isn't there isn't really one Kurdish language, for a start. Now, there are, well, some people say seven. They are not written languages. Some of them are relying on Persian. Some are much more Turkified. And when you hear Kurds actually speak, they speak a patois in Diyarbakir, which is partly Turkish, with some Kurdish words, some of which are obviously Indo-European. But it's not a written language. And when the Europeans arrive and say, you must allow publication of Kurdish things, you find that the newspaper in Diyarbakir, which produces something like 1,000 copies, simply isn't read. People might read the football results from it, but they cannot otherwise read it. You set up a school in Batman to teach Kurdish. There will be an initial flood of enthusiasm, and then people get bored and want to do something sensible, like learning a language which has actually got a literature. Now, this is something which a lot of Kurdish parents would fully understand, because they want their children to get on in Turkey, and they do. Now, I'm not pretending that this is an easy matter to solve. I've been going to Eastern Turkey quite a lot in the last year or so. It's not a subject, I think, which gets written up, I have to say, particularly well. There are only two books on the Kurdish question which I respect. One is Martin van Brunessen, who's Dutch, and the other is by a Kurdish communist called Hamid Bozaslan, who writes in French. They're very, very good, both of these. They go into the anthropology and the languages. Otherwise, you get an awful lot of, I'm afraid, journalistic, propagandistic books which just repeat each other in a style which, you know, I just don't find impressive. There's always a test in these things. When you see a book on subjects like that, have a look at the man's bibliography. If it refers to the languages which are used by the people in the book, read it. If not, throw it away. There's no excuse nowadays for people to write books about complicated subjects if they don't know the language. None. Now, what the future is of Kurds, what the future is of Basques, I cannot say, but Spain and Turkey have the same sort of problem. And at bottom, it really comes down to a certain, shall we say, tangential stance towards Europe. And I would even say, with Spain in the 19th century, a consciousness all the time that the rest of Europe was rather looking down on them. If you think how the French responded, for instance, at the time of the Spanish Peninsular War, you'll see that the Spaniards really regarded, the French regarded the Spaniards more or less as a sort of third world country, which needed to be kicked, Napoleonic fashion, into modernization. And quite a lot of Spaniards agreed. After all, the country did have a world empire, and then somehow it ceased to be a creative place, except for that fringe of Catalans and one or two Basques. It had ceased to be a creative place. Now, you can see in the 19th century, with Turkey, exactly the same phenomenon developing. These people know how to do things, and we can't. If you look at any of the books on 19th century Turkey, you can see the intelligentsia responding, saying, well, you know, we've got to learn from the West. And it's a slow process. You start off in the 1780s, 1790s, by saying, we must get proper artillery. Then you realize that people can't actually do the artillery training because they haven't had proper training in mathematics. Now, why is an interesting question. And it was the ulema who closed down the School of Mathematics in 1739 because they said, mathematics is God's secrets. It's blasphemy to probe them. So Turkish gunners don't actually do mathematics. It's one of the reasons why Greece became independent, is because when it came to technicalities of this sort, whether in shipping or in artillery, the Turks, the Muslim Turks, or the Muslim Ottomans, if you want me to put it correctly, couldn't handle that kind of thing. So then you set up schools of mathematics. Then you need people to repair things. Then you realize that you need to educate people to educate people to repair things. And then finally, out of the Bureau of Translation, which sprang out because of the needs of diplomacy, you are setting up the first of the foreign language schools, which was the Galatasaray School, which used French, opened up with a pompous rescript from the then Sultan. Then you proceed to train civil servants properly, and you realize after a bit that you're going to have to use English. Just an example of how Turkey approaches Europe. I might tell you how the Turks came up with football. Right up to the end of the reign of Abdulhamid II in 1908, you weren't supposed to play football because the Islamic people regarded bare male legs as sinful. I may say, by the way, I'm entirely on the side of the imams about this. if one could take the last rock singer and strangle him with the guts of the last footballer, I'd be delighted. I've no hope of this. Now, in 1908, the Young Turks come in, and they legalized football, and it happened this way, that in Izmir, Smyrna, where there was a big Levantine community led by, well, the British being predominant, football was played. And it was then a game for gentlemen. And it spread to Moda in Istanbul on the Asiatic side. And there was a team called the Black Sox. Now, the Young Turks, I mean, this time without capitals, younger Turkish males, wanted to play football and did so only semi-legally and set up a team called the White Sox. In 1908, the club Beşiktaş was formed out of this, which the colours of which to this day are black and white. Well, now, you see, the Turks are moving all the time, groping their way towards some kind of modernization all through the 19th century. It didn't have the kind of political cataclysms that you get in Spain in the 19th century. Civil war, shall we say, in Spain was always more or less endemic, so far as I can judge. And it sometimes flared up, you know, with the Republic in 1870, and then another sort of monarchy in 1871. And again, a point in common with Turkey, the army coming into politics more and more. Quite an interesting phenomenon, also a Turkish phenomenon. Now, Spain got the civil war of the middle 1930s. Turkey got the same sort of phenomenon, I suppose, with the First World War and all the cataclysms that came with it. But we're not in the end talking about something which is generically very different when we talk Turkey and Spain. And if we can say, you know, to the Turks, there's been a Spanish miracle, you can have one too, then I think the case fits. And Spain has been a miracle. I remember, you know, when I was a small boy, my mother, who was quite strongly influenced by the left wing of the 1930s, would never go to Spain. She said it's a dreadful place. She wouldn't dream of it. Neither would A.J.P. Taylor, you know, the great historian. He refused to go to Spain. Now you look at Spain, booming modern place. It's now, I believe, the biggest investor in Latin America. I think there are four Spanish banks are the biggest banks in Latin America because of the old ties. The Spaniards know how to do things. I wish in a way the Turks would learn from Spain, because Spain's made mistakes which Turks ought not to make, starting with the Benidormization of so much of that tourism belt. The Turks making exactly the same mistake, building concrete hotels in each other's backyards and ruining the coast. Can you tell them this is a mistake? No. You might also say, and I think this is a dangerous thing, that in Spain, the emancipation of women, which was obviously needed, has gone together with a collapse of the birth rate. Now, what causes this is a very good question, this collapsing birth rate in the Mediterranean. It's probably, in the end, something to do with property prices, which I gather were very strictly controlled in Spain in the Franco time, with the usual result that property either costs millions or you can live almost parasitically for nothing, and with nothing in between. Now, obviously, at that point, children are going to be something no one can afford. There's a wonderful book, by the way, John Hooper, The New Spaniards. I'm a great fan of that book and have been borrowing from it quite extensively. But at any rate, the comparison with Spain, I think, should be enough for us to take the expansion of Europe into Turkey pretty seriously. I could expand a little bit more on it, but you won't want me to go on too long. 10 minutes. Oh, fine. Well, I've got about 10 minutes. If you look into the Turkish past, now you find some very interesting phenomena. You think, and obviously the Austrians, I'm afraid the Austrians are an intolerably parochial lot. The Austrians obviously thought that there were going to be millions of Turks, Muslim Turks, camped outside Vienna. The Viennese voted against an Austro-Hungarian exhibition to be done together with Budapest in 1992 or 1993. The idea of the Turks, completely people from Jupiter, arriving. And so, you think, Austrian fashion, that the Ottoman Empire is the banners of the Prophet, green and all that. Now then you start looking into it. What actually was the Ottoman Empire about? Well, it's not a question of Islam emerging from the heart of Anatolia and creeping up towards Vienna. It's not that. What happens is that in 1071, obviously the Seljuks come in and take over most of Anatolia. Their allies at that time were the Armenians, because the Armenians had a great quarrel with the Byzantines. Now then, there, in one form or another, there is coexistence in Anatolia for the better part of 500 years, with a considerable amount of intermarriage. I mean, it's a curious fact that the queen must be related to the Ottoman dynasty through some sort of comnenus marriage in the 12th century. I'm not quite sure, because I cannot work out how the Komneni would turn into the House of Hanover, but it must have happened in some form or another, maybe through the Lusignan, I'm not sure. At any rate, quite a bit of intermarriage, and when our old friend the Arab traveller, Ibn Battuta, arrived in western Anatolia, he would see people, you know, women without headscarves, bottles all around. The court of the sultans used Greek as the court language way into the 1430s. And, of course, the Turks went over into the Balkans a century before they even took Constantinople. They were taken over by Genoese ships at the behest of a faction in a long Byzantine civil war, established themselves in the Balkans, some of them becoming Christian, the origins of the Gagauz, incidentally. Then they start intermarrying, so that the Mehmet Fatih, the conqueror, was actually three-quarters Balkan Christian, and preferred, if I remember rightly, to use Greek or Serbian than anything else. Byzantium was collapsing. Why? Not because of the Turks. It was collapsing because of the Latins. The Genoese and the Venetians were fighting over the Black Sea trade, and they manipulated factions in Byzantium. And the Genoese built their great tower on the other side of the Golden Horn, not against the Turks or the Russians. They built it against the Venetians. When the Turks took Constantinople, the place was already a ruin. Behind those walls lived 50,000 people, mainly poor. The great palace of Constantine had fallen in, and the emperor was reduced to living in a sort of two-up, two-down palace called the Blacherni, and he was so poor that he could only mint one coin, poor old Palaiologos. Now, at a certain point, the silly ass, peace to his soul, but he was a silly ass, thought that if he challenged the Turks, then the Pope would come to his rescue. So he said to Mehmet Fatih, I'm not paying my rent anymore. And Fatih thought, well, let's close the place down. Which happened. Who built the gun that smashed the walls? A Hungarian. Who was the man who conquered Greece for the Turks? A Byzantine, Zagranos. Half the Byzantine nobility simply passed over. How deep the conversions were, I don't know. But when Mehmet Fatih did come into Constantinople, his first port of call was the Orthodox Patriarch. Now, the Orthodox Patriarch had been unable to use the Hagia Sophia, which was closed during the siege, because if the Latins and Greeks tried to worship together, they started fighting. It was only opened on the very last evening. Then he sits down and he talks to Gennadios, and they do a pact that the Hagia Sophia is handed over as a mosque, but the Orthodox Church becomes the largest landowner in the Ottoman Empire. The Patriarch rides around with three horsetails. The Turks, being nomads, use the horsetail as the badge. They also, incidentally, decorated the Topkapi Palace with a pyramid of skulls to give the general idea of what would happen to people who disagreed with the Turks. And that pyramid of skulls remained there until the Kaiser visited in 1899 and remarked to Abdul Hamid that it was jolly tasteless, whereupon it was removed. Now, the Pasha could ride around as the most honorific dignitary of the Ottoman Empire, and so it went on. Now, there's a wonderful book full of black humor. One that I think is his best book is Stephen Runciman's Great Church in Captivity. It's a wonderful book about what happened to the Orthodox Church under the Turks. And the problem is not that the Turks oppressed it, but that it fell apart itself into all sorts of bribery and corruption and even murder. I believe it's the truth, well, Runciman says so, that of all the Greek patriarchs between 1453 and 1918, only four died in office in their beds. The rest all, you know, got whatever happened to them. Still, the fact remains that in its early days, first century and a half, the Ottoman Empire is really a sort of Greek-Turkish condominium. There's a marvellous Greek historian, Dimitri Kitsikis, who talks about this kind of thing. Now, what I'm really saying is, I suppose, just to sum it up, that there is in Anatolia, past and present, a strong strain of, well, shall we call it Europe? You know what I mean. And it means that when the westernizing reforms, the ones we all know about, start in the 1920s and 1930s, that they are actually building on something. That the most interesting thing about these Ataturkist reforms is that a very large number of the religious people went along with them. They didn't oppose. You see, things like the alphabet change, I think that is probably the biggest single change that Turkey had, was scrapping the Arabic alphabet and using a Latin one. It was done with some Hungarian advice, by the way, because the languages are quite similar. Getting rid of that Arabic alphabet was pretty well essential if you were going to have any kind of mass literacy. Arabic, I stand correct to be corrected, by the way. Arabic has got three vowels, not very strong. Turkish has got eight. Arabic has got a proliferation of consonants, where Turkish doesn't really. And if you want to write the Turkish language, then doing it in the Arabic script can lead to all sorts of ambiguities. Geoffrey Lewis, who's the great expert on this, actually quotes a sentence written in the old way, which could mean 12 different things. You had really to know in advance what the Arabic or Persian word was in order to realize what the sentence meant. Now, something like that is going to hold the people back terribly badly. How did the artillerists learn, for instance, in the First World War? When they sent messages by Morse code in the First World War, they had to transliterate from the Ottoman into French. Then encode it again, sometimes in figures. And then the whole process has to be repeated at the other end. This, by the way, is one reason why there are so many mysteries about the Armenian massacres, simply because how many people can read those documents? And if you want to have a modern country, you've got to hit that problem of the alphabet. But what is interesting about it is that the religious people, on the whole, went along with it. There were, in the University of Istanbul, people who dragged their feet. Atatürk, being Atatürk at that time, Reşit Galip, Hasan Ali Yücel, some great men, just simply said, right, and I'm sure anyone with experience of universities would be cheering at this point. They all said, well, let's close the damned university down and have another one. And they did. They got a Swiss professor to come along and do a report. He said, the library's useless, the students are not concentrating, the dons are not paid, and I'll go and do something else. The usual, you know, all universities are unhappy in the same way. And, she closed it down and opened up for business and got a tremendous piece of help when Hitler opened up for business as well, because there came a troop of Germans headed by Einstein and Hindemith who were offered chairs at the Istanbul University. Einstein didn't take it because during the Vin d'Honneur, the Minister of Education said to him, Professor, we've forgotten to work out which hours you're going to lecture. He said, I don't want to lecture. So he went to Princeton instead. And Hindemith came back to Turkey, so did Bartok, several times, without quite committing themselves. The musicians' union in Turkey wouldn't have Bartok because they realized the competition was too much. Now, what I'm saying in the end is that there were, and it's an important point to make, there were in Turkey people on the religious side who would collaborate. Now, that's not really true, as far as I understand it, of places like Iran, or again, as I understand it, Egypt. That you were dealing in Turkey with an Islam which wasn't like Islam to be found somewhere else. It was willing to learn. That the days of the ulema, forbidding schools of mathematics, were not really to be taken too seriously. Well, now, I think come to the end. I mean, let me simply end up on a very tame note. As I say, when I lived here, well, I still live here, living here, you don't really think Europe's, well, you don't get excited about it. It is all these, you know, kind of summits in places like Tunbridge Wells, or, you know, and they preach in us, and there's boring parliament, and all the apparently unnecessary laws and all the rest of it. And you know, Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, I'll scream if I hear that again. It's you know, it's that sort of world, and it's very difficult to work out, I think, from this country's perspective, quite what good it does. But look at it from the perspective of Southern Europe. Look at Portugal, Spain, Italy, Greece. Then I think, you know, you say, well, Europe has done something, after all. What would have happened to Italy without Europe? I mean, Italy was, frankly, a bit of a disaster country. It coughed up Mussolini. But Italy, since 1945, has obviously been, you know, with all the qualifications, a tremendous success story. So has Spain. Portugal's being a bit slow, but I don't mind that. I thought Portugal was wonderful. Greece? No. Do you know, the most extraordinary thing has happened to Greece. I used to get a little sick of the Greeks telling us that, you know, they, that democracy and all that were Greek words, and always thought, well, so is neurosis. in the sense that someone agreeably defined as neurosis is that condition which realizes its own worst nightmares. And Greece is obviously becoming a civilized country at last. Now, if these processes can be extended there, trade, interchange of all sorts, some rough rules about what countries can do and what not. I mean, the Western European Union, probably the best example of this, then why not stop? Why not expand into the very country which I think needs us most? Thank you.
Okay, well, I'd certainly like to thank our speaker for that interesting tour through European history. We have some time for questions. It is usual that we have microphones placed around the room, so when you raise your arm, can you please wait for the microphone to come to you? I'll ask you to ask a question rather than to give a speech. We'll take the gentleman. Do we have a microphone? Yes, we have a microphone in the upper balcony. Could you please identify yourself and keep to a question, please?
My name is Tuncay Güren. I'm from Turkey. Thank you very much for this very comprehensive lecture. Well, we have one question, two correct answers, Spain and Turkey, or Greece and Turkey. I mean, they are different pairs. One of them is inside Europe, the other one is not. The answers are contradicting each other. Both of them are correct. So it gives me the idea that this question can be wrong. I mean, beginning with where does Europe end, cause a problem, you know? And I mean, my first question is therefore why there is such a question. I mean, is it a Franco-German plot to think about such a problem? Because it's obviously creates a horizon of order, you know, a horizon and understanding of, you know, where does it end, and it must be somewhere around Turkey, you know. And
okay, can we have a question, please?
Yeah, the question is why Europe is intensively focusing on the question of end when it thinks about Turkey.
Okay, thank you. The gentleman here at the front, please. Do you mind if we take about three together?
Thank you. John Newham. I would like to take the view that Turkey is both part of Europe and of Asia. And my question... Oh. Shall I start again?
Please.
Right. John Newham. I take the view that Turkey is both part of Europe and Asia, and for the same Russia. But my question basically is, what are the implications of the Turkish application to join the European Union for, first of all, the Turkic peoples in Asia, like, you know, Kazakhstan, but also for the secular form of Islam, which it seems far more moderate for many people than some of the places like Iran?
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Put it, the lady in the centre here.
Test.
Yeah, to get someone else, but please go ahead. Go ahead.
You finished in your conclusion. I'm sorry, I'm Heather. I'm a master's student here. You finished in your conclusion talking about a couple of the other great things that Europe had done, and mentioned the Western European Union is just kind of a throwaway. I'm wondering if you can expand on what you mean using that as an example of coordination, etc. Why that came up in your statement.
Okay,
can I answer that one very briefly first? I made a mistake. I meant the Council of Europe. And that's about five sensible things scribbled down on the back of an envelope.
Do you want to answer the other questions now? Okay.
Yes, I don't really understand why. Well, you know, why people wonder about where Europe ends is, in its way, yeah, kind of quite a sensible question, because, but as I say, I'm not sure you can really answer it. Where does Russia fit in? Can you reconcile Orthodoxy and Catholicism, which is what Alain Besançon says? I was reading him this morning. He makes the point that democracy has settled down in places like Poland or the the Czech Republic, but hasn't done terribly well in places like Russia and Romania. Has this something to do with orthodoxy? Well, I just can't answer that sort of question. No idea how to answer it. It's obviously a very important question to ask, but how on earth do you do it? So I'm afraid I'd have to pass that one. The question of Turkey in Asia is again it's a very good one. I mean, I think a lot of people would entirely agree that a good part of Turkey is definitely the Middle East, and you're conscious of the change the minute you get. I would have thought, to the airport at Ankara, which is where Tamerlane fought his battle. And in those days, you could hide elephants in the forests, which was long gone. I sometimes wonder, because there's been huge migration from east, well, into Istanbul, and my flat in Galata, I get, it's very modern, typical of Turkey, the techno music on a Saturday night from the other side of the Bosphorus, and it stops at about 2:45, and you think, sleep at last, and then 10 mosques at full belt when you start out. There's going to be a very interesting case, I think, when if the Turks sign up in their present negotiations to European noise levels. It'll lead to a very interesting court case or two. A lot of it is Middle East, but even as you go through Eastern Turkey, it's very, very varied in atmosphere. Erzurum, for instance, is quite pious. The problem of 8 mosques waking you up. But if you go to Kars, it's an entirely different atmosphere, and I think Van is too. Well, with the spread of Europe, with the spread of the sort of prosperity which Western and Southern and large parts of Central Turkey have, what is going to happen there? It's very much up in the balance. I really don't think it would be a good idea for the Europeans to slam the door on Turkey, because it means that no encouragement is given to people who are either want really to be Christian Democrats, if you like, or others who are Republican secularists. I mean, it's absolutely right for Europe to support them. Is that right?
Okay, thank you. Can we
pass about Central Asia, by the way. It's something, am I permitted to say I don't really know enough about it?
Can we take a few more questions? There's the gentleman at the front in the middle of the balcony. Yes.
Hello there. I was just wondering, from your perspective, what would you make of the implications, the benefits that Europe would have of Turkey being admitted, that the EU would gain from Turkey's admission? Any ideas there?
The gentleman down here on the left.
Thank you. I want to ask a question. Professor, will you think a united Europe is forming at the moment, or in the future, a united Europe will form? Do you understand my question? Will you think a united Europe is forming in the future? Or another question is, about 50 years later, in this Europe, who will live in the European Union? Because everyone come from all over the world will live in this European Union in the future. That means European citizens, partly they are European origin, but partly they are all over the world. Any idea about that one? Thank you.
Thanks. The gentleman here at the front.
Hi, I'm Stefano Sevribido. You said you were a former Eurosceptic, and as a born-again European, are the only advantages of EU, can they only be found in Spain, Portugal, or Greece? Can you find none for Britain?
Three nice, brief questions for you.
I've not anything terribly startling to say about what Europe would get from Turkey, but the facts are pretty obvious, in the sense that trade has been going up at about 15% per annum. I mean, I can see the wave of prosperity now, which going around parts of the country you'd be quite surprised to see. If you go to Cappadocia, for instance, I remember going there 10 years ago, and it was all sort of donkey carts and covered women and dust all over the place. It was very nice, a lot of it. But you'd go and you'd see biblical villages lit by candle. You'd see long rows of mustachioed men with caps sitting doing nothing at all outside the tea house. The women in shalvars busy monkeying about with the agriculture. And I mean, I say it was extremely charming in many, many ways, but it's been transformed. I think it's growing too fast now. A place like Urgup in the middle of of Cappadocia is actually quite a prosperous place with lots and lots of returning German Turks retiring there, this kind of thing. And in Istanbul, property prices are shooting up, I think, alarmingly. I wouldn't want to see that city find itself in the position that London's in at the moment, where the young simply can't afford to live anywhere, generally speaking, except miles and miles away from where they're supposed to do their work. And, well, let's put it this way, people like me, who had the sense to buy property in the 1970s, obviously laughing all the way to the old folks' home. But I'm afraid the Turks have caught up with it, but you can see that process spreading. And again, it does need to be said, there's this demographic deficit problem in Western Europe is a bad one. Now, there was a meeting in Germany, I think about 6 months ago, when they discussed the business of Turkey's membership. And, since on the whole, the Germans are not enthusiastic about having more Kreuzbergs, a large part of them, of the people present, said no. Now, it was the Deutsche Bank man who just got up and said, look, would you rather, when you're in your 70s in the old folks' home, be looked after by a 70-year-old German nurse or a 20-year-old Turkish one? And the argument, I think, actually swayed the body, as it happens. And that, of course, is a very, very important point. And also, I think everybody who has to deal with Turks, except, some of the time in Germany. I think the Germans have got a special problem, I don't know why. I think everybody else would agree that it's rather fun dealing with Turks. It's not, certainly nobody in this country would quails at the thought of it, whatever the silly Austrians think. I can see from the sort of people I'm teaching that they're well read, they work in a disciplined way, they've got a sense of humour, they've got, it's a bit, the way I explain it is, I think it's a bit like 1950s Italy in social atmosphere, that sort of conservatism, but with emails. And I think that's the gain for Europe, something which is expanding fast, and I hope I'm not wrong. I think your question was about what the effect of immigration on Europe will be. Now, it's an enormous question, this. There are obviously tremendous pluses to be had out of it, if you get it right. I think, on the whole, I agree with The Economist about this, which wrote about the immigration problem, saying, look, you can't let people in and not let them work. Got to do that, because if you simply keep them sitting around in camps doing nothing, obviously it breeds trouble. On the other hand, clearly it needs some sort of control, because we can see from what's in the papers about France today, that kind of problem is there, and it's going to create a backlash. So, bit of one, bit of the other is all I could really say about it. Good question about what did England get out of Europe? Well, I think everybody who went through the 70s. Sorry, listen, I'm very old-fashioned. I say England, even though for obvious reasons I should probably say something else. But I don't believe in speaking passportese, and UK is passportese, and Britain is newfangled. So we'll have to say England for short. When we all were very enthusiastic about Europe, it was specifically in the context of this country being about half as well off as Germany. And if you had a British passport in the 70s, then you looked at it every morning lovingly and said, which is the country which is going to be the blessed recipient of my presence? Because it was very difficult. And people voted for Europe because it was an answer, it seemed to be an answer to the problems. What we now get out of it, well, I suppose it's just too much hassle to get out, isn't it? I'll leave it at that if you don't mind.
Gosh. Okay, time I think for one final round. We'll take the gentleman at the front here.
Thank you. Alan Ingram from UCL. There's a sort of geostrategic debate about Turkish membership of the EU, that bringing Turkey in will either represent some kind of firewall against the instability of the Middle East, or it will provide a bridge for Europe into the Middle East, that it has some kind of geostrategic function to do this. And there's a sort of debate that goes on in Washington DC and European capitals about whether Turkey should be in or out for those kinds of reasons. It's really a two-part question. And also, the Turkish parliament showed that there was a limit to the extent to which Turkey would be was willing to be seen as a sort of geopolitical staging post for the invasion of Iraq. So my question is whether that kind of thing shows that this geostrategic debate is really a projection of European and American anxieties rather than Turkish realities, and whether this really matters very much for Turkish accession into the EU.
I mean, you're absolutely right to have asked that question, because of course it's a dimension I've completely ignored. So do an awful lot of Turks, you know. I think they wish they could set up a wall on that border and simply pretend it's not there. It is there. It creates trouble. I mean, frankly, a large part of the Kurdish problem really came about because trade with Iraq was interrupted for 15 years or something like that, which means that that part of Turkey is far poorer than Kocaeli in northwestern Anatolia, the Istanbul area. It's you know, it's dry agriculture, all that kind of thing. Yes, I mean the geopolitical factor for Turkey as a sort of, if you like, a kind of citadel for in an area of vast instability. It is obviously vastly important, and I don't think that small-scale European concerns should get in the way of it. On the other hand, the one big problem is that Europe doesn't pull together when it contemplates the Middle East at all, does it? Which complicates things again terribly badly for the Turks. And it's not making the West as effective in the Middle East as it should have been, because it's pulling all sorts of ways, and we've got the problem of Iraq going on and on and on. With Turkey, I'm afraid, getting God knows how many refugees pouring across that border at the moment. It's a very worrying thing. I wish I had an easy answer.
Perhaps we can just squeeze in one final question. The gentleman at the back here, please.
Hello, my name is Yossi. I'm a PhD student from Tel Aviv University. And until 2 weeks ago, probably a neighbor of yours, I was living in Turkey for a long time in the Galata area. I would like to ask a question regarding actually the question that was asked previously about the European Union and the Middle East, and if you, I might be allowed to fantasize a little bit. Let's say that Turkey
could you
is
fantasize with a question, please.
Yes. No. Turkey is in the EU, and Cyprus is obviously right now in the EU. What could be the next step? I mean, I can imagine Israel, for instance, or the whole the Levant, the eastern part of the Mediterranean, going through there. Remembering, keeping in mind that part also had a very strong ties with the EU, with Europe. And what do you think about it?
Well, do you know, I hate to chicken out of this, but there is a very good legal answer that the Turks have been legally in the queue since the Ankara Treaty in 1963, was it? I don't think any other country has been, which very neatly clips off any other argument, doesn't it? And because the others would all be divisive and even offensive. And it's best not to have to strike that note unless one absolutely has to. And the fact is that the Turks are just legally in the right. Full stop.
It's nice to finish with precision. Thank you for coming, thank you for your questions, and on your behalf I'd like to thank our speaker, Norman Stone. Thank you.